Hey, what's up, guys? I'm going to show you this new interview I just recorded this morning with Dr. Marty McCary, who's from Johns Hopkins University. I just wanted to let you know, first of all, for those of you who follow my work, you'll probably recognize that he says some things that I definitely don't agree with. But as a journalist and somebody who's trying to bring you the wide range of opinions and views from doctors and scientists out there, not just what you're hearing in the mainstream, I felt like I wanted to share his views because he does say some interesting things about masks, about the vaccines, and specifically about how this relates to kids. I don't agree with his calls for mandating vaccines or putting masks on kids in any situations, but nonetheless, I wanted to share his views with you. So please check this out. All right, welcome back, everyone. This is Derek Bros, and we have a very special interview for you today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Marty McCary, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Carey Business School. He's also the author of The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. How are you doing today, Doctor?
Great to be with you, Derek. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are here in Texas. Schools are going back this week, next week, the coming weeks, and really around the country. Many parents are concerned in relation to their kids, COVID, masks, and vaccines. And you've written two really interesting pieces recently, one back on July 19th called The Flimsy Evidence Behind the CDC's Push to Vaccinate Children. And the second one was a piece that you were involved in from August 8th called The Case Against Masks for Children. So I want to talk to you about some of the data that you presented in these op-eds here, because I think, again, it'll be relevant to parents who are preparing to send their kids back to school. Just to provide you a little background before we get into this of what's happening locally, in Houston and different parts of Texas, the school boards have been meeting in the last week to decide to mandate masks for kids. We have several different school boards, including some of the largest school districts, the Houston ISD, choosing to go ahead and do this. There have been parents who've been coming to protest and push back. And so I want to try to provide parents all around the spectrum of this conversation with some accurate information about what you're finding and maybe help them inform their decisions for what they're going to do with their kids. Let's go ahead and start with one of the first points you made in your piece, The Flimsy Evidence Behind the CDC's Push to Vaccinate Children. You mentioned this number, 335 children at the time having died of died of COVID. It's been about a month since then, and I know the numbers have increased, we've been told, but I think your point here still applies. And what is the point you're trying to make here by looking at that number 335 and in relation to the data that the CDC may or may not have and how valuable that might be?
Yeah, Derek, first of all, thanks for having me. So I arrive at similar conclusions as our public health officials do, but for very different reasons. So, for example, when they put out the statistic that we have to vaccinate all kids because that's the only way to sort of dig out of the pandemic, they imposed that very strong, vigorous recommendation without really good data at the time. And that was what was concerning to me. Now, I've since really come to believe that giving a child, say 12 to 15, one dose of the two-dose vaccine, if the kid is low risk, is a good strategy if the kid does not already have immunity. But the CDC went ahead and vigorously recommended this rigid two-dose strategy for all kids to over 12, regardless if they have natural immunity, regardless if of their individual situation, and requiring masks on 56 million children, really based on one number. And that number was 335 deaths in kids under 18. That's a big group, by the way, almost 72 million kids. So we've had 335 deaths at that time. They've never called any of those families, or I should say each of those families, to confirm whether or not COVID was incidental or was the true cause of the death. They never identified the risk factors for kids dying of COVID. It turns out pre-existing conditions may be the vast majority of those kids, or nearly all of them. And that's important information. And how do we not have that information? That was what was boggling to me. Is just, we have 21,000 people who work at the CDC, and they never once looked into each of these 335 deaths to tell us what the risk factors were and whether or not COVID was the true cause of the death. So I arrive at similar conclusions as the CDC and public health officials, but I do think it's worth being very honest with the public about the information. And the reality is it's hard for this virus to hurt someone young and healthy. And I think getting a vaccine for them helps reduce community transmission. But one dose is a good strategy because it confers 100% immune protection in the short term based on the Israeli study of kids 12 through 15. And you avoid the cardiomyocytes and pericarditis complications associated with the second dose. They're clustered around the second dose.
So you mentioned that you feel like the one dose of the J&J might be a better strategy. What do you say to parents who feel
actually,
like
one dose of Pfizer?
Oh, Pfizer, excuse me.
Indicated right now for kids 12 through 16.
Excuse me. So the Pfizer. What do you say to parents who still feel like they don't believe the risk, whether the risk of COVID or the risk of adverse reactions from the shots, is still worth? You know, they're children being vaccinated and they're going to say, hey, well, you know, I appreciate that, but we're just going to opt out for the kids completely. Do you think they're still, given what you were just stating about the low risk generally, that the kids will still be in a comfortable position?
Yeah, first of all, we've got to respect each other in this country and we've got to respect that decision. It is hard for this virus to hurt someone young and healthy. So the reason I would recommend it if I had kids of my own, and the reason I do recommend it for my sister's kids as a single dose after age 12 is that we want to reduce community transmission. And it's not as much to prevent death as it is, because that's so rare for a healthy kid. It's exceedingly rare for a healthy kid. But it's to prevent also this inflammatory syndrome that we see after the viral infection. And there's probably been 10,000 of those cases in the US during the pandemic. And it can be painful for a child, and it's something that's avoidable. And I think that part of the concern of the vaccine is the heart complications, and you really reduce those dramatically, if not eliminate that risk, by avoiding that second dose. Now, for high-risk kids, go ahead and get the second dose. The benefit's probably there. But I think it's worth being honest with people and respecting people's decisions, and we've got to stop shaming people who make that choice.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I want to move to another point that you made here, and you kind of touched on it a moment ago, that when you were looking at the data on children, that you see a mortality rate of zero without a pre-existing condition as leukemia. This is such as leukemia, and this is based on some research that you've done with the nonprofit Fair Health, looking at COVID data for children from 2020. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So one big question my research team has had is, and I think a lot of American parents have had, is, has any healthy child ever died of COVID? And that's a very reasonable question before, you know, putting 72 million kids under tremendous restrictions. And the reality is the CDC cannot tell us. The Senate, after I published that article in the Wall Street Journal, the Senate in a hearing asked the CDC director and the head of the FDA if any healthy child has died of COVID. And they said, we don't know. How do we not know that? That's something we need to know. So my research team looked at a data set which we had available in collaboration with this organization. And what we found is that in looking at about probably a quarter of the nation's data on children, roughly, in that data set, we found that all the rare deaths that occurred were in kids with a pre-existing condition, and no healthy child had died. Now, since then, I've asked doctors, do you know of any healthy child that's died of COVID? And there have been a couple cases that have been presented to me after really making a national call out to say, if you know of any, please let me know. This is useful information. This is our scientific process. And unfortunately, I'm sort of sensing that in right now with our public health guidance, there's one point of view and they don't want to hear other points of view. And I do not think that's healthy for our scientific process.
So you made another point that I want to touch on, because I think it relates to not only children, but it's something we've seen with adults. And this is the reporting of the cases. You specifically talk about whether a child has died with COVID or because of COVID. And you mentioned CDC Director Rochelle Walensky claiming that vaccinate a million kids would prevent, you know, one death over 4 months. But you go into looking at some of the problems with these arguments. And can you talk a bit about that? What is the concern here, the problem for a parent who might not be aware of how they're reporting this data of, again, the deaths on of kids or even adults with COVID or because of COVID?
Yeah, so when the CDC decided on child vaccinations, they did it, I thought, in such a sloppy way. Now, I was very critical of that process, even though I arrive at a similar conclusion. But it's worth looking at what they did. The FDA did not convene its external experts when they considered the COVID vaccine for kids. That is a very atypical step. And there was almost sort of this rush to get it done as if it was, you know, something we had to do for a larger agenda without going through the normal process. And that's something that bothered me. Then the CDC issues this very stern, rigid recommendation with data that wasn't really that accurate. They said if we vaccinate a million kids, we would avoid a couple hundred hospitalizations. Well, that data comes from a report on adolescent COVID hospitalizations the CDC put out that overcounted hospitalizations for COVID. They even later acknowledged that as many as 47% of them had an incidental COVID test. Because remember, we're testing everybody who walks into a hospital right now with a very sensitive PCR test. So again, I just think we deserve better. We deserve good data. And I'm not downplaying that kids are in the hospital with COVID, but we deserve better data when parents are trying to make this decision. And by the way, all this stuff hurts credibility of public health. And right now we really need to focus on getting adults who don't have immunity vaccinated. We're losing about 60 Texans per day from COVID. That is the number of Texans dying each day from COVID. None of those people needed to have died. And that's the tragedy. What I think has been a barrier has been the loss of credibility with public health. Some people just, you know, absolutely refuse to get it. And I have friends like that, and I'm constantly encouraging them to get it. Some come around when they see a loved one who's struggled. Trust me, not being able to breathe is one of the worst feelings in the world. You don't want to have to deal with that if you can avoid it with a vaccine. But also the FDA not issuing full approval, that's a bureaucratic delay right now. They're not waiting on safety data. They're waiting on another bureaucratic step, and that's hurting the cause.
So I want to switch gears now to go to your second piece, the case against masking children. And you bring up a couple of points here. For one, I thought it was important that you noted this. I hadn't come across this, that in March, Ireland's Department of Health announced that it would not require masks in schools because they, quote, may exacerbate anxiety or breathing difficulties for some students. And in addition to that, I want to talk about, you know, the anxiety. You talk about a little bit about the psychological impact. But the first point you get into is whether or not masks themselves on children are even effective at reducing transmission. You note that there's only been a single retrospective study on the question and the results were inconclusive. So can you talk a little bit about that? What does the data actually say about masks on kids, and then maybe more broadly, masks generally?
Yeah, thanks for the question. First of all, I'm very pro-mask. As a matter of fact, I've been wearing a mask most of my life. As a surgeon, when I was busy in clinical practice, now I've been doing mostly public health research for several years. I don't think my patients want me to operate without a mask on. The quality of the mask matters. And I think that article in the Wall Street Journal got a headline, which I was disappointed with. It kind of made it sound like it was an anti-child mask article. And really the point was to say that we've assumed there's zero harm with masks. But the reality is some kids really struggle with masks. Some kids do well with masks and other kids really struggle with the masks. And we've got to consider special populations, those with disabilities, special needs, those with hearing loss. It's not a small group. It's 160,000 kids in school, right, who will be going into school with hearing impairment. Some kids wear glasses, like 25% of school kids, and they fog up and sometimes they can't see when they're trying to learn. And the mask can alter their breathing rate and rhythm. And that's because you're breathing in a little more CO2. It's not at a toxic level, but that does alter the breathing rate and rhythm a little bit because the body may be trying to blow off more CO2. Well, guess what? 40% of cases of anxiety are associated with some irregularities in breathing. And so there are some downsides to masks, and adults downplay them. But, you know, even though, say, 20% of kids get bad outbreaks of acne with the mask and adults downplay it, if you're a kid, if you're an adolescent, that could be the most stressful thing in one's life. And we are seeing suicides and suicide attempts go way up. So, and I did not like the blanket recommendation that every one of the 56 million American kids in school need to wear a cloth mask, even though it cloth mask may slightly reduce transmission. There's no studies on it. And the effect is probably small. Let's assume it's a small reduction in transmission without considering these other issues. And so it begs the question, should the decision be local? I believe it should be. Should parents have a say? I believe they should. But these are issues that we've never really asked before. I'm not anti-mask, but if the kid struggles with a mask, I think we need to pay attention.
Yeah, I think those are important points there to make. Let's talk a little bit more about the, you touched on it again briefly, the psychological impacts though, besides, you know, anxiety, just being a kid that's going to school while they're hearing about COVID and, you know, a lot of the concerns around it. I mean, that I think is traumatic. You mentioned the rise in suicide rates. We've also seen other studies looking at rise in depression in kids. And this is, I think, a real world impact that maybe isn't considered all the time. But how would you respond to a parent that says, well, you know, maybe that's real or that's a concern, but so is COVID?
Yeah, first of all, if a child or their parent wants them to wear a mask, they should. And if there's any concern, they should. If the kid has a lot of risk factors for COVID, is very high risk, maybe they want to hold off on going to school during the Delta wave. It should be peaking within a few weeks, and then we could see a decline fairly rapidly. We'll see. We'll see what the rate of decline is. But Delta is a temporary thing. When they instituted mask requirements, they had no exit criteria. That's a mistake, especially since people have been sort of, you know, led down trail last year. They're appropriately sensitive. Masks may slightly reduce transmission. I believe they probably do, although the cloth mask is such a minimal impact on transmission, probably ranks number 6 in terms of things we can do to protect kids from COVID after ventilation, airflow, distancing, podding, which is kids work in clusters of kids in pods, so there'd be less risk of transmission. And then vaccinating adults. When you vaccinate adults, your transmission goes way down. We have zero data on masks in kids that have a comparison group in the study, which makes a study credible. I'm not talking about a randomized control trial. I'm just talking about a good comparative analysis study. The NIH has spent more money on the Wuhan Virology Institute than it has on studying masks in kids, which is zero. That's how much they've spent on masks in kids. And we're a year and a half into this. If we're going to require this for every kid, I think we need some better data to guide us. That's been the principle they've used for other things in COVID. So for a parent, I'd say, look, it's reasonable to have your kid wear a mask. I would even say in an area of an active outbreak, it's reasonable for all the kids to be strongly encouraged to wear a mask. But for kids who really struggle, for kids, you know, maybe a child like my cousin's friend who I didn't know this guy, but he recently committed suicide and describes the last year when he went to school with a mask as being just miserable. And I think we've got to factor all of that. If we save one life from a mask, but lose 5 lives for other reasons like that, I think we have to consider all those things. It's really saddened me to see the massive fighting over masks in kids, because it's a minimal effect, if any. There are some downsides that are being distorted, ignored, and sometimes overplayed. And that's not our battle right now. Our problem is not masking a 3-year-old. Our problem is non-immune adults not being vaccinated, showing up and overrunning hospitals in Texas and in other parts of the country. And that's where we should be focusing all of our efforts right now, not having these culture wars.
So I want to touch on, well, first off, thank you for that answer. And I want to touch on, there is one of the lines in the second piece, which I know you didn't necessarily agree with the title, the case against masking children, but you start suggesting, you know, different mitigation strategies. And there's a line here that I thought was curious given some of the other statements you made. I'd like to hear you elaborate on it. You say that mandatory vaccination of all teachers and other adults who lack natural immunity, which teacher unions have vigorously opposed, would also help. So are you're in favor of requiring vaccine mandates for, you say for teachers, but What do you mean by other adults? Do you mean generally like the adult population, or what is your view on that?
So I think essential workers that deal with vulnerable populations should be vaccinated. And we've got to account for natural immunity. One of the greatest failures of our medical leadership has been ignoring natural immunity from prior COVID illness. Natural immunity is real, it's effective, it's durable. There's 18 studies that have supported it. And yet it's been ignored on this broader vaccine fanaticism. And we've got to have a scientific approach. Now, look, I'm as pro-vaccine as it gets, but if somebody had the infection and recovered, there's no good evidence right now that they must get the vaccine. They can, and I recommend one dose in many of those patients that ask me. But the idea that, you know, we're going to fire somebody because they have antibodies, but it's not, they're not the antibodies we like against COVID, to me, that's preposterous. So teachers inserted themselves into the vaccine allocation line. If you remember, despite schools being closed, they got the vaccine earlier than other vulnerable Americans. And we thought it was in order to get the schools reopened. Now we've got 90% of teachers vaccinated, and about half of those unvaccinated have natural immunity. So almost every teacher has immunity. So I think it's reasonable to ask, just as we in the hospital as healthcare workers are required to have the flu shot each year, it's reasonable to require immunity of essential workers that take care of vulnerable populations, in my personal opinion.
And your thoughts on that for the general population? Do you support, for example, the conversation, as I'm sure you're aware of, is lately vaccine passports, mandates of that sort we're seeing in New York City, San Francisco, New Orleans, LA. What are your thoughts on that? Do you support those type of measures?
Well, I actually, when our businesses were all shuttered, and mostly in the northern United States, I actually wrote a piece of the Washington Post saying, hey, requiring proof of immunity, that is, you already have immunity from a positive COVID test or an antibody test or a vaccine, even if it's one dose, requiring someone to show that immunity and giving them added privileges in society when everyone else was shuttered, that is, letting the restaurants be open when they were closed to those who had immunity, to me was a reasonable strategy early on. But what it's turned into has been this idea of blocking people out for not having immunity. And right now we've got very high population immunity. The unvaccinated pose no serious public health threat to the vaccinated beyond that of a common cold. And they've been demonized, and it's hurting our messaging in trying to encourage them to get vaccinated right now. And mandating some of these things like, you know, vaccine mandates and employment mandates, college mandates for kids to get both doses of the vaccine, it's polarizing people. It's hurting our cause. I believe as a physician that, you know, we have a lot of experience taking care of people who don't want to do things we ask them to do. You win more bees with honey than fire. If you can be positive and encourage people, share testimonials. That's what they're watching right now. They're watching on TV, local hospitals overrun. They're hearing from their friend that one of their loved ones was on a respirator. And it's driving people right now to show up and get a vaccine dose. That's how you're most effective. If the politicians never said anything about vaccines, we'd probably be in a better place. People would listen more to their local physicians. So I think a heavy hand sometimes can be counterproductive.
All right. And so I want to just elaborate on that as we start to wrap up here a little bit. So I appreciate your sharing your thoughts on the vaccine passports. You know, in my my reporting, I've had the opportunity to interview different families and folks who are people who, I don't know if they label themselves anti-vaxxers, but they would probably be deemed so by the media for being skeptical of the COVID vaccines particularly. And, you know, just particularly folks paying attention to the vaccine adverse event reporting system, VAERS, which you mentioned in your first piece, and people seeing a spike in reports of deaths and various types of adverse events, as well as just testimonials people are posting on social media. Now, of course, one of the criticisms of VAERS is people will say that anybody can report anything on there. It's not been verified. And you point this out in your piece, and you suggest that the CDC and the FDA should assign doctors to research each of the thousands of vaccine complications that have been reported. So with the understanding of that, can you I guess, do you understand, or from your perspective, do you see why people are skeptical, or maybe are still not wanting the vaccine, and, you know, hesitant about it, or maybe just resistant because they see things on VAERS, and whether or not we can verify what is exactly true? You know, these are the kinds of concerns and things I have.
So the CDC and FDA are broken. They are broken. I would even say the NIH failed us during the pandemic in the sense that they spent twice as much money last year on aging research than they did on COVID research. That's a disgrace. These bureaucracies are so bloated, so inefficient. They're held up in so much red tape. I think people sometimes forget that the FDA blocked universities from doing their own COVID testing early in the pandemic when cases first landed on U.S. soil. And they wanted like a CD-ROM with the application for permission burned on the CD-ROM sent by snail mail in addition to the electronic application filed. And it delayed things weeks, and it's just an absurd, absurd, sad story of how we got behind the eight ball. And these organizations are not fixed. I mean, these organizations are broken. And if you look at one of the failures, it's the inability to provide accurate information in a timely fashion. And that also applies to vaccine complications. Now, I'm still one to believe the life-protecting effect far outweighs the complications, even extrapolated to the complications that we don't know of. That is, if you talk to doctors practicing around the country, you get a good feel for the complication rate. And still, the safety profile of the vaccines are impeccable and life-saving relative to 70 Texans dying a day of COVID. But when it comes to kids, it appears that the complications of heart inflammation are clustered around that second dose. It's the second dose that leads to that complication. Is that dose even necessary in the short term? Can you stagger it out to 3 months, as I did with my own two-dose vaccine regimen? I took the second dose 3 months later because it gives better long-term immunity. And so do kids need both doses? The VAERS reporting system is shoddy, relies on self-reported data. It's complicated. It's not easy to go on there and report a complication. And I have heard of severe complications that really never made it to the VAERS data system. So look, I still believe in the vaccines, but why do we have such a shoddy reporting system to track complications? And if you think about the history of that bureaucracy, the pharma industry has never really called for or desired a great post-approval monitoring program, right? If a drug gets green-lighted by the FDA, does pharma really want an intense system for monitoring complications after approval? They're probably not aligned to really call for that. I think now we should come together as Americans and say, look, regardless of one's party politics, we need a better run set of federal agencies. We need to be able to pivot quickly, and we need honest and good data in real time. And it's not political. That's something we should all agree to.
Well, I appreciate that. I have so many more questions, and I could continue to pick your brain. Maybe for another day, we'll continue, you know, with the conversation, have you back on. But I do appreciate your time and sharing, your knowledge and expertise in this area, especially at this important time, as parents who are going to be hearing this are going to possibly be making their decisions based off some of the information that you've presented here, as well as their own research. So thank you for joining us.